March 28th, and welcome to all our guests. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3377. And Judith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 3377 authorizes the Department of Transportation to discipline vehicle dismantlers for violations by revoking or suspending their certificate or to place a dismantler on probation. It would allow the department to adopt rules to implement the measure. We have received a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to call up Daryl Fuller and Jack Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association. Thank you for hearing this bill today. House Bill 3377 is really a housekeeping bill that still needs a little bit of housekeeping before it's priced to move. We've been working with DMV on a set of amendments that should be ready shortly, and we believe that we will be able to come back to you and with some amendments that everybody's happy with. Over the last couple of sessions, the dismantler industry has been working with DMV and better regulating itself through DMV and through the licensing process, and so we're catching errors as we go, and this is just sort of one more step towards getting where we need to be. Current statute allows DMV to either revoke a dismantler's license or to fine them, but the statute does not give DMV the latitude to suspend a license or to put a dealer on dismantler on probation or take other intermediary steps prior to completely revoking a license, and they want to be able to take those steps and work with the industry and the licensees in order to make sure that they're complying with the statutes and with the rules. And so what we've concluded is that we would like the legislation, rather than to spell out sort of the steps that the DMV can take for dismantler, that we would prefer sort of broad statutory authority for writing rules that the industry can then work with DMV and make sure that the rules stay compliant with current industry practices without having to come back to the legislature every 2 years to make the kind of minor adjustments that we're doing now. And so we had a long meeting in my office last week. We've agreed in concept on what we'd like the amendment to look like, and I've circulated a draft of that request to everybody, and I'm waiting to hear back, and as soon as everybody's in agreement with that draft, we'd like to send it to Legislative Council and believe we can come back with something that everybody agrees will move us forward.
Thank you. All right, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation, and ODOT is fine with this measure as well as with the amendments. We're also interested in improving our ability to regulate this industry with progressive discipline rather than with just being able to fine or revoke. We found in some of the investigations that we've done that our interactions with the industry have been primarily educational, people not understanding in some instances that they needed to be licensed and then agreeing to come into compliance after we've interacted with them. So this is a good move, and we look forward to working with the industry on these measures and the amendments.
Thank you. I don't see any questions, so thank you for coming forward, and we'll look for the amendments.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
Let me know how that goes. Close. Oh, I don't see anyone else signed up, so don't all jump at once. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3377. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3379.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 3379 allows a renter or lessor of personal property to serve a demand for return of that property by commercial overnight delivery service. It removes the requirement that a person act knowingly from the definition of criminal possession of rented or leased personal property, and it would shorten the permissible time for return of a rented item from 10 business days down to 3 calendar days from the dispatch of the demand. We have received a no revenue impact. We're still waiting on the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Well, we have Elkins, Neary, and Jackson. So,
thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Al Elkins representing the Car and Truck Rental and Leasing Association of Oregon. With me today is Kevin Neary, Vice President, General Manager of Enterprise of Oregon, and Jax Jackson, the Loss Controller Manager, also of Enterprise of Oregon. First of all, we'd like to thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for introducing this bill for us. Here's the situation we're faced with today. We rent vehicles. That's what we do. As part of the agreement, the person that signs the agreement at the rental counter agrees to return the vehicle. Sometimes they do not. The statute that you have in front of you says that a person is guilty of criminal possession of a rented or leased vehicle property if the person does not return the vehicle within the agreed-to period of time. At that time, the rental car company can send a letter of demand asking for the return of the vehicle. If the person does not respond within 10 business days from the mailing, then or return the vehicle, then after that 10-day period of time, the rental car company can report the vehicle stolen. That's the current statute. What House Bill 3379 does is still says a person is guilty of criminal possession of rented or leased property if the person does not return the vehicle within the agreed-to period of time. However, if the person does not respond to the letter of demand or return the vehicle within 3 calendar days from the date of mailing, then the rental car company can report the vehicle stolen. So we're going from 10 business days to 3 calendar days. The bill also allows for a letter of demand to be sent by certified mail like now, but it also adds that the letter of demand can also be sent through any commercial overnight services that can supply a delivery receipt. What the situation is today, and it's a serious one, is that these vehicles are oftentimes used by criminals. With the 10 business day language, that leaves about a 2-week period of time in which to use a rental car without the rental car company's authorization before the vehicle can be stolen, reported stolen. These vehicles are oftentimes used in, along with mischief, robbery, that type of things. The police are not aware of the unauthorized use of the vehicle and have no reason to be looking for the vehicle as it currently now stands. And this lengthy waiting period also allows car thieves and chop shop lots of time to dissemble rental vehicles. We think with the delivery of mail and tightening the number of days to where we're able to report the vehicle stolen, that will help resolve some of our problems. We'd be glad to answer any questions. Madam Chair, before that, what I'm finding out as we go through this process, the police are asking us when something happens and the vehicle's involved, they call a rental car company, Mr. Jackson's had this happen a couple of times, and ask, why haven't you reported this vehicle stolen sooner? We could be looking for it, we could be on the watch out for it, that type of thing. Mr. Jackson's reply is, I have to wait for that 10-day period of time before that owner can respond. And that doesn't sit well with law enforcement agencies where that vehicle was part of some type of mischief. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I guess I just am looking for a little clarification on where it says 3 calendar days from date of dispatch for delivery. Does that allow for time for them to receive it?
Hello, Madam Chair. Kevin Neary with Enterprise Rent-A-Car, representing Catrella, members of the committee. I'll answer that. Our industry envisions using commercial overnight delivery services like a FedEx so that, yes, the next day the delivery is made. There's an electronic receipt we can see online that it was delivered to the house. Keep in mind, please, that this is also really the second notice. You know, when someone rents a car, they say, I'll bring it back on the 10th. Typically, we're in business to have repeat customers. You know, we're not looking to do this the stroke of midnight on the 11th. A few days will pass. We're making phone calls. Phone numbers have changed. We can't find them. Okay, we better send a letter. And then this long process, and we're just trying to shorten it up a little bit. Jeff Jackson with us has a few real specific examples from our actual files that have happened within the past year. There's public safety reasons as well as for the industry to help decrease our losses as well. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. Representative Gilman?
Yeah. Can you give me some numbers, and maybe that's what you're going to do, but I want to know how big a problem I'm dealing with here.
Sure.
Or if it is a problem.
Sure. My name is Jeff Jackson. I'm the loss control manager with Enterprise Rent-A-Car. Also representing Controlla, Madam Chair and Committee. Looking at the numbers, I put together a couple stats for us. Once we send the demand letter, it takes about 13 days. In addition, the car's out of control doing whatever it's doing. Once the car's actually been putting on the hot sheet and report is stolen after that 10 days, a car is usually out of control for about 22 days.
Additional.
And in that, I actually put together a couple of recent examples because it is becoming more of a problem because the criminal element is realizing that the 10 days is out there and that our hands are tied. One of the most recent ones, which alludes to what Al mentioned with the police, is we had a renter who took a vehicle, rented a vehicle, and he was involved with several robberies at Clackamas Town Center Square. And the police were chasing him. He eluded the police, and in doing so, hit several parked cars, hit several moving cars, and eventually got away. Talked to several different officers on the phone. They wanted to report it stolen. They said, I don't understand the urgency, which I did. And the sergeant actually called me back on the phone and he said, we want to report this car stolen. We want to put it on the hot sheet. And I said, I agree. I would like to, but I cannot. We need to send a letter. We have to wait the 10 days. Also, turns out his license was suspended. Still, 10 days we had to wait. Eventually, we found what was left of the car abandoned, but quite a substantial time period has passed. The police wanted us to move. We wanted to move, but we were unable to.
Follow up.
Okay. You've given me one instance or maybe two. How many cars do you rent a month?
How many customers do we deal with?
What's that?
How many
car
customers, our industry?
Yeah, I want to know the percentage of vehicles that just happens.
It's a low percentage.
What's that?
It's a low percentage, a small percentage.
Very small, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, sure. But nevertheless, we'll go through a few of these other examples. When it happens, public safety is at risk. Jeff, if you'd like, we could...
I can tell you personally, at any given time, I have between 5 and 10 vehicles that I'm aware of that are out of control, and they're almost always the unlicensed driver that gave it away to a friend who gave it to a friend or traded it for drugs. And the biggest concern I have is the lack of control that we have or the officers have and what the criminal element are doing with our vehicles.
Example number two is another good one.
Example number two was a couple weeks ago we had a customer who called us up and said, I gave the vehicle to my boyfriend who was an unauthorized driver. Turns out that the boyfriend was a very violent and known gang member who was out, and the police had informed us that he had been using our vehicle in an armed robbery. They asked us what we wanted to do, if we wanted to report stolen, and again, we had to wait 10 days after we sent the demand letter. Had another one recently where a customer gave a car to an unauthorized... This is all within a couple-month period of these recent examples I'm giving you. Customer gave the car to an unauthorized friend, alleged that it was stolen from her when, in fact, she gave it away. The friend had a suspended driver's license. Again, our hands were tied. We sent the letter. We had to wait 10 days until the vehicle was dropped. That's all.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe as a slip of the tongue, but did you say that an unlicensed individual rented a car?
The driver's license had been suspended.
And follow up, if I may. And so in your process of renting a vehicle, you have no way to verify whether a license is suspended or not?
We do not. If they present a license that's valid and matches the description,
you run the risk that it's valid.
Right.
Thank you. I was just curious.
Any other questions here?
Nope.
Okay. Oh, another question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize for coming in late. If this has been answered, I apologize for wasting the committee's time. From a consumer standpoint, what would be the drawback of moving it from 10 to 3? I understand your perspective. Why would a consumer say no? And I know you don't want to answer on behalf of the consumer, but perhaps you could speculate.
Well, average consumer, all of us, if you rent a vehicle and say you'll be back on the 5th and you want to keep it longer, give us a call. We have no problem. You know, I mean, we're very happy. So I don't think a typical consumer this has really has any effect on.
Can I follow up with this? Let me rephrase my question. How did it become 10 days? That seems like an awful lot of fudge room for such an expensive asset.
We don't know.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I looked for the history on this, and I could not find it. Maybe somebody that's a little bit better at this than I am, but I push buttons and look for history on the original intent, and I could not find the...
I've been in the industry in Oregon here for 17 years, and it's been that way as long as I've been in Oregon.
Follow up with me. And so when someone comes in to rent a vehicle, there's a contract they fill out.
Yes.
They understand the terms of the agreement, that they're going to take it on this day and that they're committed to taking it on, returning it on whatever day they agree to, and there's a contract signed. In my view, when a consumer signs that contract, they have an obligation to honor that contract, and the notion of leaving 10 days of fudge room really, and this is just my view, is completely unfair to the private sector who has entered into a contractual agreement.
Yes. There are legitimate reasons why folks need to extend a rental car, and we're very happy to work with that. These are for the folks that vanish.
Just one follow-up. I'm assuming that there's language in the contract, though. If there an extension is needed, there's ways to notify.
Absolutely.
And to modify the contract to get an extension.
We're very happy for cars to be out-rented when people are paying us money.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm assuming that the law does not apply only to rental automobiles, correct? So this could apply to a power washer that what someone might use in their house, or something that digs up your garden and that kind of thing.
This,
Madam Chair,
rental TV could be anything. So it would seem to me that probably that when this bill was drawn up, it probably made some sense that, you know, maybe you've rented it, some equipment like that for a week and you've got to return it. So this does not just apply to very expensive automobiles. It could be something that you rented for $100.
Madam Chair, Representative Tremé, that's the way I read the statute. It's also the window washers and the trench diggers and backhoes and all of that.
Right. Thank you. So this new bill then would apply to all that other equipment,
right,
not just to automobiles. Thank you.
That's what I believe, yes.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I too, apologize. I was in another committee on another bill, but I just wanted to confirm that nothing in, as I read the language in the bill and read the description, the SMS description, there doesn't have to be any presumption of any improper, illegal, or even abusive use of the property. It just says if you fail to honor the agreement, and we can give you notification, and then you got the 3 days as opposed to 10. Is that correct? So we're really not presupposing that there's anything illegal going on. We just want to get on with the rest of our lives and hope you can too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Correct. Thank you very much.
Okay. I guess I want to follow up on my first question, because it was pointed out to me that in line 18 on page 1, since there's only little on page 2, where it says that service of written demand under this section shall be accomplished by certified mail or by delivery through any commercial overnight service. So my original question was, and I know that they've had previous amount of time, which should have taken care of it, but will this still be enough time, the 3 days, if it's certified mail as opposed to overnight delivery?
I'm not sure I could answer that. In our experience, certified mail takes longer for us to get the card back that tells us it was received. But I would think the post office is delivering that mail within a 3-day period.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I ask you to supply the committee with a copy of your rental agreement I want to see what avenues you have to solve this in the agreement already.
Absolutely. Not a problem.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, it's wonderful.
Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to change seats with Senator Smith and change the problem here and all. Just to follow up on your comment on in terms of certified mail and three calendar days from the dispatch of, for delivery. Gentlemen, is there any conceivable situation where this delivery was dispatched? You had sent out your demand, but it didn't reach the consumer until 3 days later. Then in that case, the consumer would have 0 days to get the item back. Is that a concern at all for you?
Well, yes, it's a concern. We certainly don't want to catch any innocent consumer and create any problems. This is, and it may be that we have to take a look back at that particular piece concerning certified mail. I don't know if the company would, if the committee would be comfortable with if we deleted the reference to certified mail, because that's probably the only snail mail piece that seems to be of concern and require us to use an overnight delivery service. So I think the industry would be comfortable with that sort of a change.
I'm not sure if I could follow. I just have to agree with that. That either I think you would need to delete certified mail or change the timing from the dispatch for delivery to the receipt of the consumer's receipt of that they had been delivered the notice.
Very good. It's good feedback.
Okay. Follow up.
Just so I'm clear on this, the demand letter isn't going to come until 3 days after the violation of the contract. Or would it come immediately after the violation of the contract?
It usually there's a couple of days where we're trying to reach the consumer through telephone, normal channels. You know, would you like to extend the rental? And when we find phones have been disconnected and those sort of things, it generally doesn't go out until at least the third day after a car was due back.
The only concern I have with this is family out on vacation, not the most responsible family, perhaps, and they extend their vacation for a couple days, and the next thing they know, they're wanted by the law. That's no excuse, but I'm just trying to envision the scenario where some helpless family who's not aware of the law, next thing you know, is finding themselves in violation.
We're certainly not trying to catch anybody.
I know that's not your intention.
That would be the worst public relations I could think
exactly.
of. That would be horrible.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Smith, and correct me if I'm wrong, do I understand this correctly that the delivery receipt is the key here, though? So if there was a family on vacation, they did not receive the overnight delivery or certified mail, they would not be falling underneath this statute because they had not received the notification. Is that correct?
That would be correct. They would have to be there with, I mean, we're requiring a delivery receipt,
right?
Receipt that somebody took this notice.
Representative Tomei.
First, may I ask you a question? Do we have anybody else who is going to be testifying
no.
on this? So what concerns me, gentlemen, I think you have a problem. And I also want to ask how you would rent a car to somebody who had an expired driver's license. I would assume you can't check that to see if it's a legitimate driver's license?
Expiration, we would catch and we would not rent a car. But this is a suspension where the consumer is still in possession of their license, but it's been suspended within DMV's computer, and we don't have any way to interact
I
with
see.
It.
I see. Okay, thank you. Okay, may I follow up?
Yes.
So since this does not specifically deal with car rentals, my concern is very similar to Representative Smith's, that I might rent a window washer and I've gone to the beach for the weekend or for a week, or maybe I'm out of town for a couple of weeks and I forgot all about the thing. And it seems to me that before we should move with this, that we should hear from other people who have rental organizations, not just automobile rentals.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I agree with you. And in drafting this, we were thinking that perhaps we ought to have the statute just relate to auto rental car
mm-hmm.
companies.
Mm-hmm.
We could do that. Maybe we'll ask the drafter to do that and add some of the word changing that we talked about today, certified and receipt of. So we will go forth and bring those back to you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Butler.
Madam Chair, one of the items that's been requested is a copy of the rental agreement, and I think that that's an appropriate thing for us to look at and take a look at the fine print. I don't know that the people that we're talking about that are using some of this equipment are really worried about the fine print or the large print either way. So, I think it would be useful to have that as a part of the public record, particularly if we're going to accept Representative Tomei's excellent recommendation that this probably ought to be limited to rental automobiles. I think that the folks that we're talking about are probably have other ulterior motives in mind many of the times.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. And I'll be in touch.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Madam Chair, as they're stepping aside, I have to do an unsolicited commercial for Enterprise. That company is absolutely fabulous. I travel multiple times, and I always use Enterprise. And one time in Orlando, Florida, I had a situation.
This is all on tape.
I know. Record this. The theme music will come in a moment. I was in Orlando, Florida, and I have to tell you, I had an awkward situation, and Enterprise Rent a Car was absolutely fabulous to my family. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You know how to make the reservation. You just know how to keep the reservation.
I close the public hearing on House Bill 3379. And we are going to go ahead and open an informational hearing on the statewide cost of congestion report from the Business Alliance, Portland Business Alliance. And we have Steve Clark. I don't know if we want to bring you up first and then. All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Steve Clark. I'm president of the Portland Tribune newspaper and also community newspapers throughout the Portland metropolitan area, and co-chair with Randy Pape of the Oregon Business Plan Initiative on Transportation. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to meet today and present the significant results of a just-completed study that measures the importance of transportation in Oregon's economy and the consequences of travel delay on our citizens' quality of life. We think and we believe that you will agree that the study's results and the lessons we have learned from numerous business interviews included in this study are eye-opening. We believe that this study provides a stark picture of the future. We also believe this study serves as a call to action for the 2007 Oregon Legislature and all Oregonians to decide immediately to invest more in our transportation system in a significant way. We must do this strategically, and we must do it sustainably. The genesis of this report started in the Portland region a few years ago. A group of business leaders decided it was no longer useful to simply talk about transportation in transportation terms. At the time, we decided that we first must fully understand the connection between the economy and our transportation system, and only then begin to build a business case for making strategic investments in transportation. In turn, the public and private sectors in the Portland region came together to commission a study about transportation congestion and the Portland regional economy. We learned that without additional investments, the annual cost of congestion would grow to cost the metro area $844 million and 6,500 jobs each year by the year 2025. It would grow to that consequence annually. As a result of the study, the conversation in the region and really, frankly, throughout the state and in the nation changed due to an understanding that transportation and the economy are inextricably linked. Following on this regional effort, there was an expressed desire to take the study statewide. The 2007 Oregon Business Plan made that commitment to complete the statewide study and to initiate a business-led effort to work with the Oregon Legislature on a strategy for significantly and strategically expanding transportation investments. Statewide business groups and public sector partners came together to commission the statewide study. Interviews were conducted with businesses in various industries throughout the state. A steering committee of business leaders was formed, and a public education and outreach effort has been initiated to engage Oregonians in better understanding and evaluating this important matter. We believe this study, as well as the significant response that we are hearing throughout Oregon, signals a growing recognition about the impacts of transportation on the transportation delays on the economy and a willingness to begin now to invest more significantly and more strategically in our state's transportation system. This study is not an end in and of itself. However, it should serve as a catalyst to propel Oregonians, business leaders, the 2007 Oregon legislature, and Governor Ted Kulongowski to initiate an immediate discussion and decisions this legislative session about investments in our transportation system. But we should also talk about critical outcomes. As you well know, without a healthy economy, Oregon, an income tax-based state, will not be able to invest in critically needed programs such as public education, health care, human services, or public safety. In a few minutes, you will hear about the study's findings, and you will also hear from individual business people about the challenges they face as a result of deficiencies in our transportation infrastructure. You will also hear more about the current state of the system and what lies ahead. The bottom line is that Oregon is at a crossroads. Other states are investing in their transportation system. We must also. Our state's economic competitiveness and the quality of life of our state are at stake. Each of us has a choice. We can accept the challenge and opportunity before us. We can work together. We can engage in leadership and investments that make a difference. By working together, beginning now, we can provide the kind of future we would like for all Oregonians. Good jobs and economic prosperity, great communities, a safe and sustained transportation system. And by doing so, we can provide the revenues needed for other important public priorities. We cannot wait. By waiting, we will continue to fall behind and place Oregon at greater risk. We must choose to act decisively, act together, and begin to invest now. The cost of doing otherwise is simply too high. Thank you very much. And if I may, Marion Haynes from the Portland Business Alliance will provide the cost of delay, traffic delay, and congestion for you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, representatives. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Marion Haynes, and I am with the Portland Business Alliance. Ann Gardner with Schnitzer Steel has gone ahead and joined me up here, and she'll be able to provide the perspective of an individual business. We interviewed many in the study, but she's here to tell her personal story. I'm just going to walk through the PowerPoint that you were handed out. This study, as Steve mentioned, is following on a study that we did in the Portland region. Many business associations and public partners from throughout the state came together to help fund this study and bring it to fruition. On the first slide, we tried to ask three questions. It was designed to look at, from a business perspective, does it make sense to invest in transportation? What is the business case? What's the impact on the economy, on jobs, on competitiveness? And so we asked these three questions. With regard to the first question, whether the state's economy and the transportation system are linked, we first took a look at what we have as far as our system here in the state. Our geography and our past investments have made the state a sea and air gateway and a rail and highway hub, and the state's economy has really grown around these connections. There are 23 port districts in the state, 9 with intermodal freight facilities. The Port of Portland, which is the preeminent port in the state, is recognized as the shortest route from U.S. to Asian markets, the quickest route from any port on the West Coast. There are 23 railroads, including high-capacity transcontinental mail main lines of both Class 1 railroads. And again, that is recognized among West Coast ports as being one of the most efficient rail routes because it goes at grade through the Columbia Gorge rather than having to go over mountains, and so there's a lot of savings there. 97 public use airports, 7 with commercial airline service. This is of growing importance. Air cargo is one of the fastest growing modes used and is really important for high value to weight ratio products as well as perishables. And the state is also supported by 2 interstate highways, I-5 and I-84, which are major north-south and east-west trade routes that come together here in the state. And as well as the 7,400 miles of paved state highways. This is very important because these provide the last mile connection to the rail facilities and the marine facilities and the air facilities. It's a system and it all needs to work together. The study really focused on traded sector industries. These are the industries at the foundation of our economy because they bring new money in, selling their goods and services and products outside of the state. Because these traded sector industries do sell their products outside the state, they depend on a good transportation system, and they don't need to locate here. They're not tied to the state in a way that your local grocer or dry cleaner or something of that nature would be. So those transportation connections are very important for them, and keeping those connections intact and efficient is important for their ongoing competitiveness. Oregon jobs are highly dependent on transportation. More than 400,000 jobs in Oregon, or 1 in 5, are either transportation-related or transportation-reliant. Approximately half of those jobs are in the transportation-reliant traded industries that we just talked about. The other half are in related industries such as logistics and wholesale trade. Logistics in particular is a high growth field. As you can see on the graph, logistics jobs are supposed to grow 18% by 2013. Traditionally, manufacturing jobs provided a lot of opportunities for living wage jobs. As the manufacturing sector has declined as a percentage of total employment, logistics sector is really growing and helping provide those opportunities for living wage jobs for non-college graduates. The next slide shows that...
I feel ignorant. I don't know what a logistic job is.
Logistics jobs are those that are part of the supply chain management, so helping to map out the route the products take. Often a product goes from a truck at a company onto a rail line to a marine facility, over, you know, to Asia, back on another truck, and so these are actually very technical jobs that require high skills, and although not a college degree, and so they're a good opportunity.
All right, thank you.
The slide that we were on, the freight movement is doubling, more than doubling in the state. The value of freight between 2000 and 2030 is going to grow from $530 billion to $1.3 trillion in 2030. The forecast also shows, you can see the top line there is the total value of freight that's growing, and you can see that all the modes are represented, but trucks really carry the vast majority of these goods. They are the workhorse of the system. They will carry 85% of total commodity value by 2030. Currently, they carry only 79%. So the economic importance of trucking is continuing to grow. And as I said, it's important because they do provide those last mile connections to some of the other intermodal facilities around the state.
I have another question, Madam Chair. Thank you. I don't know, maybe somebody else will be answering this question, but I'm concerned that freight movement stays pretty static. Will somebody be talking about that?
Freight movement stays static. I'm sorry. The slide about freight movement.
Rail. Thank you.
Well, Each of the modes, it's the slide is a little difficult because of the scale here, but each of the modes is growing. The only one, actually, if you read the full study, that's not forecast to grow significantly is pipeline, and I didn't include that on this chart. But each of them are growing. As I said, air is actually growing at over 200%. It's just a little bit hard to see on this chart because it's a very small fraction of the actual goods moved are carried by air. Each of these are growing to one degree or another. They just don't carry as much of the product as trucks do.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I previously had requested from the Department of Transportation and have not received an item that I would like to take a look at, and that is what has happened historically relative to 100% of the freight over a period of at least 50 to 75 years, how much is being hauled of 100% of Oregon's freight by each of the various intermodal transportation methods. How much is being hauled today? What percentage is being hauled today by rail in relationship to 10 years ago, 50 years ago, and 100 years ago? Same with regard to barge, same with regard to trucks, same with regard to planes. Now, I'd also ask that same question in addition to commercial freight about passengers. I would really like to see that, some history, and what direction we're going. There's probably not, while there are no buggy whips here, I don't want to be investing our resources and working towards something that may be on its way out, or really where we ought to be putting our money, and that which is the most economical and the most intelligent way for us to be moving freight. And so I'd like to have some of that. It's been over a month, maybe 6 weeks since I'd asked for that, and I would still like that number, that information from the Department of Transportation if we could get it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, wait, Representative Gilman, I forgot.
While we're interrupting.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The rail, although there is an increase, what factors, my question is, did you consider any ways to enhance that rail capacity? Ways that we could influence that to push more freight onto rail?
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, the study wasn't really designed to give us the answers, and these kinds of questions came up a lot in the first study as well. And really, what it's trying to do is just show us what that relationship is. And I think that all those types of things are conversations that need to follow. The next slide gets on to question two, which is what is the impact on businesses of deficiencies in the transportation system? And what we learned is that businesses are already feeling the impacts. This goes over the different ways in which transportation deficiencies may impact a business. Congestion, I think, comes to a lot of people's minds when the capacity of a road is just exceeded by the level of traffic. But there are many more examples from around the state about the ways businesses are being impacted. Deficiencies in intermodal connections between rail, air, and marine terminals. Shortcomings in the existing road infrastructure. Sometimes that might be that there's only one road that gets you from point A to point B, and if there's some kind of an outage, you don't really have a way to get around that. Shifting location and shipping requirements of businesses. One of the things that we learned is that the technology is changing and trucks are growing. Semis that used to be 48 feet are now 53, and that can cause trouble on some rural roads where turning radiuses and things of that nature, the roads just weren't designed to accommodate the kind of trucks that are being used today. The next slide shows some of the ways that businesses are impacted. I'm going to not do a whole lot on this one and let the business person here to talk to you about that, but I will say that we interviewed 10 businesses from around the state. We had done 16 interviews in the Portland area. Various kinds of industries are represented, various regions throughout the state, and although there were differences by region, as I mentioned in the last slide, everyone is feeling the impact. Of note here, too, is the importance of reliability for business travel. As traffic delays increase, the chances of an incident or an unexpected backup increase exponentially. So while you may forecast a 20-minute trip to get you somewhere, if there is a flat tire or a traffic accident or something like that, then that trip becomes 30 or 40 minutes, and you have to plan for those contingencies because you just never know when they're going to happen, and that has an impact on businesses. Just a few highlights that I'll hit so you can get a sense. Roseburg Forest Products recently purchased new particle mills in the eastern U.S. In their interview, they said that this decision was significantly impacted by the limited transportation options for shipping products east. Intel has moved up its last outbound shipment to Portland International Airport 4 times in the past 8 years due to growing congestion. If they miss a flight, that can have ripple effects for production lines across the globe. Georgia-Pacific, as I mentioned, theirs was really an example of the changing nature of the truck size and how that impacts them. They are banned on some roads due to their inability to negotiate them, and so approximately 400 trucks per day must be rerouted, adding approximately 100 extra miles to the trip, and that comes at a significant cost. The next slide shows that what's really critical about this is it's not just time and cost that affects the businesses. It really reduces their market access. It's easy to imagine that you can go 100 miles in free-flowing conditions, but it would take you the same amount of time to only go 50 miles when the roads are backed up. And so this really inhibits businesses' ability to cast a wide net and reach large labor markets, customer markets, supplier markets. It affects all these different things. Really, all this adds up to competitiveness, and business competitiveness is impacted by deficiencies in the transportation system. All of the factors listed on this slide affect business decisions about where they locate, where they expand, and so each of those things is impacted by the transportation system. Finally, the last question we asked, well, what is the impact then of investment? What difference can it make to our economy? And to do that, we looked at 2 future scenarios from the Oregon Transportation Plan, a base case and a larger level scenario that expected increased growth or increased investment. What we're looking at is rapid travel growth, the context that we're working in. It's going to continue to grow for many reasons. Oregon's population is supposed to grow by 41% by 2030. That's going to have an impact, and car travel roughly increases with the level of population. But truck traffic is rising dramatically due to expanding buyer and supplier markets, increased globalization, which is really key for Oregon given its gateway location. Also, overnight delivery. I found this very interesting. UPS, FedEx, and those types of common carriers are one of the fastest growing segments largely because of the Internet. And you think you're staying home, you don't have to get in your car and drive to the store, but that product comes to your house in a truck. And so that's actually a really fast growing market. So this graph shows the increase in miles traveled and the hours of travel by 2025. These increases are even larger in metropolitan areas across the state, such as Portland, Salem, Eugene, Bend, Medford, and the coast. In the Portland region, that trucking growth is actually 120%, because there's much of the state's product moves through there on the highways to get to markets east or foreign markets. The result of this is that at the future base case level, if we continue down the path that we're on, congestion will worsen and traffic delay. We'll be facing an additional 1 million hours of vehicle time delay per day, 338 million additional hours per year. That's over and above the amount of time we're already spent sitting in traffic or due to delay on the system. The next slide shows that if we make additional investments, we can save a good portion of this delay. We're not going to be able to get rid of congestion growth that happens with a growing economy in a growing state, but we can reduce the growth and reduce the impact. These savings represent nearly a 20% reduction. And again, this understates the full value because these are based on averages and don't take into account some of those incidents and reliability and the variability in the system. So finally, what's the bottom line? What is this relationship? We've quantified this number, and what we found is that if we fail to invest, Oregon's economy may lose $1.7 billion in $16,000 jobs annually by 2025. That number starts out slower in the beginning and goes up to hit that $1.7 billion mark in 2025, and then keeps growing after that. You can also look at it in the reverse, that if we make the investments, that Oregon's economy can benefit by $1.7 billion and those 16,000 jobs. And this number, the $1.7 billion, is both income generated in the state, and also a portion of that is personal time, which is shown to have had a value. We didn't take into account the environmental benefits of less time spent idling, but that is a cost as well. And finally, the last slide just shows that this isn't a matter of just manufacturing businesses or trucking businesses or logistics jobs. Transportation really benefits all businesses, professional services, health and social services, retail, trade, construction. It really is about the whole of Oregon's economy and about Oregon's livability and its ability to provide jobs. So, thank you.
Okay. I don't see any questions right now, so we'll go ahead if Ann, you want to go ahead and start?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann Gardner. I work for Schnitzer Steel, and Schnitzer Steel participated in both this study and the previous Metropolitan Area Cost of Congestion study. And we were delighted to do so because we had our own story, we knew our own story about what congestion was doing to our business, but we suspected that if you began to tell the story in an aggregate, you really began to have a feeling about what's happening to business all across the state. Just a little bit of background about Schnitzer Steel. We're an old Oregon company, been around 100 years. We're in the business of collecting end-of-life steel products, reselling those to steel mills here and in other locations for the remanufacture of new steel products. We have Oregon locations in Bend, Eugene, Salem, Grants Pass, White City, and Portland, of course, as well as the steel mill in McMinnville. And so what I'd like to do is just give you a specific case study because I really think it's illustrative of what other businesses are experiencing around the state and talk to you a little bit about what's happened as a result of traffic congestion as it affects the steel mill operation in McMinnville. Over the last 20 years, we've invested $125 million in that plant, basically to rebuild the facility. We rebuilt one rolling mill. We added another. We have replaced the melt shop, and we've added new capacity to make new products, coiled wire and also have implemented a number of measures to eliminate waste and to be more environmentally sensitive and, quite frankly, to allow us to be competitive head-on in the world marketplace. The guts of our operation is a 3,000-degree melting furnace, which we need to keep operating all the time. And to feed that melting furnace, we require a formula of scrap metal depending on what the needs of our customers are. So it's not the same formula from day to day, but we have to have the right mix of steel, of scrap, in the yard. And if we are oversupplied in one particular kind of scrap, then we're wasting valuable outside storage space. But we absolutely cannot be undersupplied to keep that furnace running. So that requires constant delivery of scrap from our facilities around the Pacific Northwest, from our scrapyard in Portland, from Fresno and elsewhere. Let's talk specifically about getting scrap from our North Portland scrap facility, where we used to be able to make 3 turns a day with trucks from North Portland to McMinnville. Now we can only make 2. Because while we're using freight routes between Portland and McMinnville, there has been commercial and residential development that has occurred along I-5 and out 99, but there has been no corresponding investment in the highway system. So those 3 turns a day that we used to be able to make now are 2 turns a day. So we're less efficient. We need to hire more drivers and hire more trucks. That affects the bottom line. And while our folks at Cascade have made the investments and they're making every change to the operation and being as efficient as they can, there just hasn't been a corresponding investment, a similar investment in the transportation infrastructure to facilitate and support that business investment. And we would advance that that's happening elsewhere in the state and certainly elsewhere in Portland, because businesses around ours, particularly in the Portland Harbor, Gunderson, Oregon Steel, Cascade, Northwest Pipe, Advanced American Construction, they have been investing hundreds of millions of dollars to stay competitive in the global marketplace, and they are all similarly affected by congestion on their operations. If you'll excuse me, I need to look down at my notes for one moment here. So why is this important? Why is it important to keep a business like Schnitzer Steel competitive? Because we will be in business only as long as we can compete head-on with companies in Korea or China that are making steel, or for that matter, a non-union operation somewhere else in the country. But specifically, Schnitzer Steel serves a service to this community, because if you're recycling steel, this material doesn't end up in a landfill somewhere. It's more energy efficient to make steel from recycled scrap. And quite frankly, the steel mill provides 500 really terrific jobs for the men and women of McMinnville. Those are manufacturing jobs with full benefits. So I simply offer this as one example, but it's not the only example. We have suppliers of scrap that are coming to our Portland location every day from around the state, from Pendleton, from Eugene, the scrap recyclers, and they call us frequently from the road saying, we're stuck in the curbs on Terwilliger. We're stuck where I-84 comes to a near standstill when it merges with I-5. So that means we need to keep people on staff at our yard in North Portland. That accounts to overtime. So the bottom line, just wanted to show this as a case study, that this is congestion has a real impact on real Oregon businesses. John Carter, the president of CEO, spoke at the Oregon Business Summit in January. And this was the topic that he spoke about, because he's very concerned, as are their CEOs, that, oh, thank you so much. I recorded this at 33, and I feel like I'm playing it at 78. So. So many Oregon businesses, all Oregon businesses, rely on the highway system. And it was our competitive advantage for decades. But there's a real fear that we're falling behind, falling dramatically behind. And as our population has increased, I think 72% in the last 25 years, we simply have not made a corresponding investment in our highway system. So in closing, we were delighted to participate in these cost of congestion studies, because our study, when combined with others, begins to tell a real story. And it's a story that we have to take action on. And it's our responsibility as business leaders to come and tell you our story. And then together we need to find a solution. And I thank you very much for your time.
Representative Butler.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And thank you for your testimony. Thank you very much for the information. Do you have service by rail to your yards in McMinnville?
We do. Both the McMinnville plant and the Portland yard were built and designed to operate largely by rail. And it's a very long conversation about why that isn't really working very well for us, but it's not. And I could just hit some highlights. But the paradigm, the way the railroads operate, is different today than it was 10 years ago. And primarily the class ones are interested in providing service delivery to the large unit trains. We're only sending, by comparison, a small number of cars from Portland to McMinnville. Problems for us is when we would call for rail service, we might not get the cars when we needed them. They might not send us the number we asked for. It's likely they wouldn't pick them up when we needed them picked up. Leaving Portland to get to McMinnville could take 2 weeks. The price, I'm going to pull a number out of the air, but I think it's not bad. If 2 years ago it was $700 to ship a rail car, this year it would be $1,200. So all in all, it just makes more sense for us, financial sense, operational sense. We can't let the furnace be unfed. We've shipped to truck. So we're still using rail when we can. Gotcha. We've been talking with the folks from the Union Pacific. They're trying to make some changes. They understand our issues, but we've got to keep the fire burning. So now it's 50 trucks a day, hauling between 25 and 30 tons a truck.
Madam Chair, my comment about all of those deficiencies that Anna has brought forward relative to using the railroad today versus 10 years ago would be that ain't no way to run a railroad. Now, while I'm not involved in running a railroad, somebody is. And those folks have tremendous amounts of rights of way, and they're given a lot of advantages to operate in the state of Oregon. I think railroad is the second most efficient way to ship things in relationship to supposedly in the underlying cost, second only to shipping by water. And if this was the first time I had ever heard this issue of much higher cost, much slower service, inability to provide the cars, don't want to serve your company because you don't want what we're only willing to give. It looks like to me that in this whole discussion, maybe as we talk about, and we'll have a further opportunity to talk about lane miles and road miles and cost per road miles in relationship to Oregon and other states of our size and population, but I'm still wondering where the railroad folks are at the table here. And finally, Madam Chair, I'm not a tax and spend kind of a guy, but a couple of years ago when I heard this same conversation, 8 years ago, I said, you know what? We'd ought to put a goal for the railroad companies to meet the needs of Oregon manufacturers. And if they will meet the needs of Oregon manufacturers, we will let them continue to operate with impunity in the state of Oregon and do all the things that they do today. But when they fail to meet those needs, then what we need to do is we need to put anywhere from a 1 to 5 cent per gallon diesel tax for them to use the railroads that they have the ownership of, because what they've done is effectively they've shifted the shipping responsibilities from the railroads over to the highways, costing us more money to use the highways and this higher congestion cost. Well, again, I'm not a tax and spending kind of person, but I'm looking at that and I'm saying it really is a cost responsibility. If they won't take the responsibility to meet the needs of Snitzer in McMinnville, and we have to depend then upon an already overloaded commuter system, and I hate to call the highway and freeway a commuter system because really it was the truck taxes that paid for those systems to start off with. It was the diesel tax that paid for much of the interstate system. Bottom line is, here we are again receiving information that the railroads are really not doing their job. And I don't know what their job is. If they don't want to service us in Oregon, let's find somebody that does, rather than continuing to invest more and more time, energy, money in our highways. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I have Kimberly Landis and Anderson Hay.
I'm frustrated.
Oh, okay. Okay, we can do that.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here to visit with you all this afternoon. I'm Randy Pape, President and CEO of the Pape Group, also a member of the Oregon Transportation Commission. So hopefully I can shed a little bit of light from that perspective to many of the questions that you may have. Also the past chair of the Oregon Business, the OBC, Oregon Business Alliance, or Oregon Business Committee. So with that, I'd like to make a few comments today and also introduce my grandson, Charlie. I'm a grandfather today with spring vacation going on, so I'm helping out on the home front as well. It would help me a great deal in going forward if you all could tell me that you are very familiar with and hopefully have read Freight Moves the Oregon Economy. This was produced by the department back in 1999. It's a little outdated, and we plan to update it. And then most recently, the Oregon Transportation Plan that has many of the questions addressed in the issues. This was recently adopted by the Transportation Commission. And if you're all very familiar with it, that would save us a great deal of time rather than me reading each of these into the record. Right. Do I take that you all are all...
We got time.
Sherry!
Speak for yourself.
Well, thank you. The Oregon Business Plan, as you know, has been working diligently for a number of months on various fronts as it relates to transportation. And this has come together in the form of a transportation initiative, which you also have received in the form of the policy playbook that the Oregon Business Plan has delivered to the legislature, and it covers a number of different topics, but the one that I'm going to specifically address has to do with initiative number 7 and the transportation initiative. You've heard a great deal of testimony today about issues on freight and congestion on the state highway system that also extends to the county and city roads. Let's talk a little bit about Oregon's trade. And the numbers are clear that 400,000 jobs, 1 in 5 are transportation related or transportation dependent. Oregon is the 9th most trade-dependent economy in the United States. Oregon's population is expected to grow by 41% by 2030. Freight volumes are expected to grow by 80%, that's in pounds, by that day. Oregon invests the least per capita on transportation of any western state. 2004 analysis found that equivalent cents to gallon in Oregon is roughly one third of that in California and Washington, and one half of that of Idaho, and the gap continues to widen. Inflation will reduce the purchasing power of fuel tax by 40-50% over the next 25 years. Value of freight will more than double by 2030, from $530 trillion to $1.3 trillion. Trucks will carry the vast majority of freight, 85% by the year 2030, up from 79% in the year 2000. Most impacted are the trade sector businesses, those that bring wealth into the state, and certainly those that export from the state. inadequate transportation doesn't just create frustration and inconvenience. It shrinks the size of the market that Oregon firms can compete in. Smaller markets mean fewer jobs, fewer and less successful businesses. We've had some successes already in recent years. Thanks to your efforts, we have passed and are implementing OTIA 1, OTIA 2, and OTIA 3. Additionally, through your wisdom and counsel, we have put together Connect Oregon in the 2005 legislation. Those projects are now in the process of being moved forward and many of them are in the dirt moving phase. We're excited, along with you, about a Connect Oregon 2 possibility from this legislative assembly, recognizing the need for additional investment in the state. As a taxpayer, I choose to use that word investment rather than spending on transportation because I do believe it's the backbone of our economy and it's the backbone of our society. If you think about shutting down all forms of transportation systems for pick a day or a week, I don't think we'd be very popular. I don't think we'd have a very happy society out there when you think about bicycles, roads, bridges, walking, mass transit, rail, all the forms, air transportation, all of those various forms are critically important to every person in this society and every business that we represent in the state of Oregon. But beyond the state of Oregon, it's a regional problem that connects us to Seattle and the ports down in the marketplace down in Los Angeles. So with that, I would ask Steve if he would join me for a moment, and we'll close this session and open it for questions. In closing, the success like Connect Oregon are critical, but as the study shows, businesses need trucks to move their goods and those multimodal facilities. It doesn't do us any good to have great port facilities if we can't get the goods there on time to ship them out. Findings present a compelling business case that more investment is needed. Oregon Business Plan calls for new resources of between $300 and $350 million per year. That comes from the Oregon Business Plan, and it also comes by looking at how the dollar has changed through inflation and investment power from the last gas tax increase in the early 1990s to today. If we were here today to ask you to just change that perspective, change that amount, we'd be talking greater than 10 cents a gallon increase in the state gas tax. The federal gas tax is another issue, but that's not on our agenda today. Clearly, good investment compared to the annual loss of $1.7 billion per year. It's not just about filling potholes, not about inconvenience, but about jobs and the economy. The future of companies in all areas of the state and our ability to recruit new businesses and encourage those already here to expand. I might also add our personal business experience. We have over 50 locations located in the western United States, so we're very familiar with California, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Nevada in terms of how we relate in our transportation networks and the importance of that transportation to our organization. But in business, an advantage is only as good as your willingness to invest to keep the advantage. Currently, Oregon is not making that investment at the level that we need to. I believe this chart shows that specifically. Our call to you is urgent. This is not an issue that can be delayed, postponed, and put off for future years. Like OTIAs 1, 2, and 3 in Connect Oregon, this is action that we need to take now. It's not going to get less expensive. It's not going to get less complicated because we have a great state. We have businesses who want to locate here. We have families who are moving in here. And fortunately, we're one of the few states that are seeing growth in our population base. So we ask you to take this measure on and move swiftly and urgently to help us move and fill that gap. And that gap, by the way, in the Oregon business plan is about $1.3 billion annually. Remember, we're talking $350 million. So we're only talking about a portion of that gap in the plan that we've been discussing with you. If we wait, our political determination will be spent on getting even with rather than getting ahead of where we are today. We are fighting against inflation and rapidly growing gap to be $1.5 billion a year. Waiting another 2 years adds another $200 million or 8 cents to the gas tax. Will the political situation in 2 years be such that we can raise the gas tax an additional 8 cents over what we're asking to make up for the delay? We urge the legislature to make prudent business decisions and invest in our transportation, which in turn invests and reinvests in our economy and our people within this state and raises everybody's boat, including every individual's opportunity for improving their standard of living or enjoying our great outdoors. You all know tourism is an important factor in this state, as well as providing opportunities for education for our young people. It's great to have the schools, but if we can't get from home to schools, then they're not very effective for us. And the same thing with health care. Thank you for your attention. Steve?
Madam Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you. In closing, would ask you for just a few things, a handful of things. Oregon as a state is well known across the nation. We are a great place to grow up. I grew up in North Portland and haven't left. But we're also a state notorious for process. We in the business community, and we would like to ask the legislature and the governor to change that beginning now. Let's focus on investments and outcomes. We've engaged in a system of delay and reconsideration on many things. Transportation and our state's future cannot be one of those. I've often been prone to use sports analogies to illustrate points, and I may have testified before you to say that if you were coaching a basketball team and your team was behind by 15 points at halftime, as is our transportation system, you would tell your team as that coach, we didn't get behind on one play, and we're not going to catch up in one play. However, you as a coach would not tell your team to engage in process and let's figure this out. We're here to advance. We're here to invest. That requires leadership and decision-making. You folks are part of that. We as the business community are part of that too. We are willing to invest in outcomes. I close with one other investment analogy or one other analogy. The chart that Randy shows you is from the Oregon business, the Oregon Transportation Plan. It illustrates that the current level of funding and extrapolated over the next 5 years, it goes 2010, but it would continue to 2030, basically calls for about $2 billion a year in expenditures throughout the state of Oregon. Regardless, over the next 25 years, that's going to be about the relative level of funding that we have available. The state transportation plan, as spoken to, as adopted by the commission, which is appointed by the governor, shows a $1.3 billion shortfall. To adopt that plan, to enact that plan, we have a shortfall. That's going to continue to grow, as Randy illustrated earlier, in the next 2 years before the legislature meets again by $200 million, the equivalent of 8 cents of gas tax and weight mile. Imagine the economic study that you just heard the results of. By 2025, the cost to the state economy and the citizens of this Oregon will grow by $1.7 billion a year annually, 16,000 jobs, if we continue on the pace that we have. I cannot tell you of that 1.7, that's an annual number, how much of that will occur in the next 2 years, but let's just guess for sake that it's another 200 million. 200 million, 200 million, $400 million? Can we allow ourselves that much time for process? And in closing, I'd offer this example. When I was putting myself through Oregon State, I painted houses. Then the windows were double hung, open from the top, open from the bottom. If you open a window, as we would choose to by engaging in process for another 2 years, without asking our basketball team to begin to catch up, we would get very cold very quickly because we're opening it from both the bottom and the top. We cannot allow Oregon's economy to grow so cold. We cannot allow the system, income tax-based system of this state, to allow that to happen. All of Oregon depends on investments such as these. They are not simply taxes. They are investments in outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may, Chair Beyer, just one other comment as we close, referring to the Oregon Transportation Plan on page 3, item 6, the last paragraph on the page says, Oregon's funding for highways and roads will not meet the needs. Just over 60% of forecasted highway and road needs were not met in 2004. And then it refers to a table, even though the Oregon legislature passed the Oregon Transportation Investment Acts, OTIA 1, 2, and 3, to improve state and local roads and bridges, while the legislature has previously increased the motor fuel tax, revenues have failed to keep pace with inflation and will experience a 40 to 50% decline in purchasing power over the plan period if the tax is not increased. Thank you, and we would be pleased to answer and respond to any questions that you have. I apologize, my enunciation is a little bit problematic. I'm going through my adolescence again with braces, and so it feels like I have an erector set or a railroad in my mouth, and when I tell that to my wife, she says, well, it's big enough to handle a class one, so that shouldn't be a problem.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. It's very compelling, and I've heard it before, and I'm sure I'm going to be hearing it again in the Ways and Means sub for transportation. And thanks to all the other folks who testified today. 2 days ago, during the same hearing, we had folks from counties, the rural counties, who came to tell us how terrible their roads were. And I was the former mayor of Milwaukee, and I know how bad our roads are. I was on JPAC and know how bad the roads are throughout the metropolitan area in Clackamas County. I've heard the needs there. The folks were here from the rural areas telling us, I mean, they're just in really terrible, terrible shape. They're in danger of losing their road crews, closing them down completely. So we talked to these folks. Their titles are judge, I think, but they're not judge, I think, as we think of county commissioners. Yes.
Sure.
So I asked them, one of the things we're looking at in Milwaukee is looking at the possibility of a gas tax to meet some of our needs. So I asked them what would happen in their counties if they proposed a gas tax to deal with some of their needs. And they looked across at each other very grimly, and they said they would be recalled.
Mm-hmm.
I just want you to know, we hear what you're saying. This is a serious issue, and you're asking something very serious of us. Mm-hmm. But we may not get a lot of support from the public throughout the state.
Well, Representative Chair Beyer and Representative Tomei, we understand that sometimes leadership comes with its challenges, and we also understand the issues clearly in the cities and counties, even the state as it refers to maintenance. I assume you're talking a little bit about the federal timber receipts issues that's mixed in here in terms of funding county roads. In our proposal that we're talking about, remember that half of a gas tax increase or registration fee increase or title fee increase goes to the state. The other half goes to cities and counties in a 30%, 20%. So if you took $300 million, if we just use that figure for round numbers, and we're okay if you round down to 345 or up to 355, 360, that we can deal with. But 50% of that would go to the cities and counties. 30% would go to the counties, and that 30% would be $105 million. the revenue that they are at risk at losing from the federal timber receipts programs is around $90 million. Now, it doesn't. The formulas are a little bit different, and we have to work with that. But this would help float everybody's boat. It would not just be state funding. It would not be just city funding.
Yes. Thank you for that, Mr. Pepe. I guess the point that I was trying to make is that this raising taxes in Oregon is not a very popular thing to do. And even in counties where they're in desperate need for road help, the idea of raising taxes there was abhorrent to those folks. Thank you.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to follow up a little bit on Representative Tomei. I had to say, and also I'd like to ask a second question concerning Representative Butler's comments about rail. Gentlemen, I would agree with my colleague, Representative Tomei, and I've mentioned this to other people who have talked about a gas tax. If you're looking for one party to do it, it's not going to happen. It has to be both parties agreeing that a substantial numbers of members would back that. Yeah. So I just want to add to that. It's not going to happen just from one side. And I'm wondering if you have a reaction. And when Representative Butler brings up excellent comments about our rail system and the fact that for 8 years now or longer, the same stories have been heard, what, in your view, having studied this, what can we do to get out of this cycle that we're in that obviously is not benefiting our state in terms of the use of rail?
Randy, first, then I might like to comment.
I'd be happy to field that. It is a very complex issue. Remember, at the base of this, we're working with private enterprise that own the railroads for the most part, and the class ones, Burlington Northern and UP, and then of course our class twos that service those. Philosophically, they're dealing with a cost of capital issue and the tremendous amount of investment that they have to deploy within their whole system. But so, you know, it becomes an issue of where they're going to deploy that capital. You know, when they're looking at New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Dallas, those kinds of things. What we're doing, and with your help with Connect Oregon One, we're providing some incentives that are getting their attention. And frankly, the Hinkle Rail Yard is a great example in Portland, where we, through the Connect Oregon One program, are investing, and I don't recall the exact numbers, but folks from the department here I'm sure could tell me very quickly, but it was several million dollars from the Connect Oregon One. The railroads have agreed to match that in addition, and I think it's a match more, not one-to-one, but two or three-to-one. In addition, because of that, and because of some other things that we've done together with the Connect Oregon program, they have indicated that they're going to increase their capital expenditure programs in Oregon and move some other projects up on their list that were out maybe 5 and 10 years from now to get this moving forward. But it won't be an easy, simple solution. There isn't a quick fix-all for the railroads. It's a huge investment, and trying to attract that investment is competitive against other investment alternatives that those rail folks do have. And the philosophical route that the major Class 1 railroads are going today with what they would call hook and haul, they want to set up large rail trains and they want to move quickly, and they want to look at the short lines to compile those trains for them and come by, you know, grab, 50, 100, 200 cars and go. They don't, in terms of the large class ones, don't want to spend the time and the capital investment messing around like, in the smaller spurs like they did many years ago. So it's a combination of what we have to do with the class ones and the short line railroads in conjunction with strategic investments on our highway system and our port systems that are going to get us to move forward. And I like to use the example often of it's like sitting down to eat a whale. If you don't want indigestion, you better do it piece at a time. And I think we are taking that progressive step, investing strategically, and Connect Oregon is a very, very important part of that. Thank you. Thank you for the question.
If I may, Chair Beyer, the transportation system is a system, and rail, freight, marine, air is all part of an integrated system. I buy a lot of newsprint. Some of it comes used to come out of the Canadian provinces on barge to Seattle, offloaded at a marine warehouse in Seattle, and then brought to Portland by truck. If one doesn't work, the other doesn't work. We sometimes buy paper speculatively out of the Midwest, and it comes to Oregon on rail cars, and then it arrives at our newspaper printing facilities by truck. I live in Tigard. We have a short line railroad that intersects the community. And when that system is traveling through, those rail cars are traveling through Tigard at rush hour, either in the morning of the day or the end of the day, they have to use switching facilities, which are actually the rail line themselves, to offload and pick up rail cars. That could block local traffic in the city of Tigard for anywhere from 5 to 12 minutes. That becomes congestion on the roads, but the system breaks down. So our point in the Oregon Business Plan is to work to improve, as you have offered, the entire system by encouraging accountability among all players and all partners, not just one, but all. The growth in freight, the value of freight in Oregon that's going to move by bulk commodity rail is going to continue to increase. But dramatically so, the system of just-in-time delivery is just-in-time by truck. If I may, on the subject matter of taxes, I agree with you. I do not believe that every tax is a good tax. The Oregon Business Plan calls for a system of investment and a system of accountability and transparency. We do that by proposing the creation of an economic filter by which transportation investments in the state of Oregon would be passed through, whether it was on a state, a county, a city, or a regional basis, so that we can actually make strategic considerations over, are the dollars that we're proposing to spend going to be spent wisely? Now, in some circumstances, I think there will be a appointed or an elected body that will decide that, you know what, that filter said that X, Y, and Z is going to occur, but we're going to do A, B, and C. We're going to build possibly a bridge to nowhere in Alaska. All of us know that's going to happen. Sometime that's going to happen. But our commitment to you is not simply to ask you this session to begin to improve the investments, but to allow us to work with you to create a criteria of investment evaluation and public transparency, public accountability, that the results are going to be provided on the investment that you've allowed. Oregon businesses are willing to step forward and say both of those should occur: investment, accountability, and transparency. We need your help, though, to take the first step. We have proposed to leadership a series of investment alternatives, strategies to raise funds. We would simply ask you to allow the caucus process, both Republican and Democrat, to completely and fairly evaluate those and to not allow us to get in a state of saying, let's consider that next session. Let's engage in the Oregon way, which is process. It is time we engage in outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Butler. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I think I understand what the proposal and plan is. It must be some sort of a registration fee and perhaps a gas tax. Is that what's being proposed as the way out of this problem?
Those are the mechanisms that we would suggest that would be conceptually available to use. I'm sure that there are other opportunities, but the gas tax, the registration fee, and the title fee are the current methods today that generate revenues that are split 50, 30, and 20, as I discussed earlier.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Randy, this has got to bother you and Steve at least as much as it bothers me. Why is it that Oregon, for five out of the last 10 years, has been either number one or number two or number three so far as high gas prices are concerned? What is it that makes Oregon so unique with regard to its high gas prices, and that's got to be affecting your businesses as much as it affects the economy of the state of Oregon?
Chair Beyer and Representative Butler, That's a perplexing question. As I mentioned, our business stretches throughout a number of states in the West, and we have seen that fluctuate at times where Oregon may be higher, but it may lower than California. I was just in Southern California, and the total gas price at the pump was well over $3 per gallon. So, and that was an unleaded price, regular unleaded. So, it does move around, and I wish I could answer your question. I'm not that well versed in the petroleum industry, but what I can talk to is the tax portion of that, the register, the way we're trying to approach this, and there are problems with the gas tax. That would be a time for another discussion in terms of that dinosaur and how we might replace it. But in terms of today, and actually a year or two ago, the state of Washington increased their gas tax by, I believe it was over 9 cents, without the sales tax that increases it even further. So from a state standpoint, and they're at the same federal tax level that the rest of us are, but they took the steps to move that forward and created, I'm thinking it was several, billions of dollars additional revenue to address many of the congestion and freight mobility issues that we're talking about in this proposal. So we're not unmindful of where Oregon is competitively with other states in terms of the tax issues and the fees. Registration fees were well on the low side on the registration fee.
Madam Chair, I do have some other questions, but I just wanted to comment on Randy's comment there, his response, and that is, it's going to be really, really tough to sell a new gasoline tax in Oregon. As you're driving into Oregon, it says, welcome to Oregon, nation's highest warning, next 400 miles, nation's highest gasoline taxes, or highest gasoline prices, and taxes about to go up 9 cents. That's a very, very tough sell in the community where I live, when across the river, for a dime less, the same fuel can be purchased, and I without the 9 cents, and self-service and some other things. So that's a whole different issue. It's a discussion for another time. But I do have a question, and I'm going to ask it of Randy as the chair of the OTC. He won't be able to necessarily answer it off the top of his head, but there's a whole bunch of people in the room that want to make him look good, and they're going to help him get me the answer. So I've already asked for something that I'm re-requesting from several weeks ago, and I'm sure by requesting this of the chair, it won't take nearly as long to get this information. I'd like to know how much Oregon's total budget is for the Department of Transportation, and how many lane miles we have in Oregon that money goes to, and then how much then total ODOT expenditures per lane mile is, or are. And finally, I'd like that compared with other states in comparable size and population, and then some West Coast, including Montana, Idaho, and Nevada, with regard to how much they are spending in total costs per person, and then based upon the income of the individuals. I think if we could take a look at that and see that in fact Oregon is spending very, very little in relationship to personal income, very, 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 very little in terms of per person on our highways, and that we're expending per lane mile, the total budget for ODOT per lane mile, is really just minuscule compared to California or Washington or Idaho or something like that, then maybe you start to make the case. Because when I have my county commission chairs or the county judges from Eastern Oregon say to each other, well, let's see, that would be somewhere between the last or the next to the last vote we'd take, because we'd be recalled the next day. And somebody said, well, it's going to take longer to recall them than that. It'll be 2 weeks before they fully get recalled and are fed to the wolves out there. But my concern is that if we had good information, and that's what I tell those folks, is you go when we give you the tools to raise your own registration fees in Harney County, Malheur County, Grant County. When we give you the tools and you go to let the folks see that the roads in Sherman County, they're turning back nearly 3% of the improved roads. He said he had 118 miles of improved roads. This next year they're going to have three miles of those roads which will go back to the Indians. Excuse me for saying it like that, but it's just going to go back to gravel. Now, first of all, you know enough about roads.
Right.
You can't take a paved road and turn it back into a gravel road. It don't happen. It first of all, it turns into a hazard, and then it turns into a public nuisance, and then pretty soon you got people driving through fields to try and get around that former roadbed that you had there. So I'm anxious to know what kinds of things that we can start to try and accumulate, gather, what kind of a story we can tell in order to sell what it is that the Oregon Transportation Commission would like our county commissioners in rural counties to try and sell to the public.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and Representative Butler. Some great points. One, for the record, I'd like to clarify that I'm a member of the Oregon Transportation Commission. We have a Chair Stuart Foster, who is the chair of the commission. But thank you for flattering me while my grandson is here. But the Oregon Transportation Plan will provide a great reference and source of answers for many of the questions that you have just raised. Beyond that, there's other data that we can make available to you. Let me attack more at the 20,000-foot level, if I might, in terms of the cities and counties in rural areas. Remember what we were just talking about with the federal timber receipts and the loss in those counties. I'm very mindful of what we have. We've traveled a great deal in eastern Oregon. We've talked to the folks in Baker County, in Umatilla County, in Grant County, in Sherman County, and we understand what's happening. The problem with the roads is, as you make choices on roads that are less traveled and let those begin to deteriorate and eventually, if you will, mentally dissolve back into a different roadbed, and you're absolutely right. That's a real problem when you do that. But there are, I think, several ways to approach that. One is better connectivity between the cities and counties in terms of our maintenance process, and we are working very well today with many of the counties in the state. So that's not a broken part particularly, but it's one that can be improved. We're looking for funding in this package. We're also dealing on the federal level with funding to help that very issue. And if that federal timber receipts dissipates, it will break many of the rural counties' backs in terms of their ability to meet their needs. Our business proposal is an opportunity to backfill much of that. Now, as I said, the formulas are a little bit different, and it would take me longer than we have this afternoon to go into that, but we would be prepared to discuss that with you if you wish to get more involved in how that those dollars line up today with the counties and how this would backfill the county's opportunities. So a good deal of discussion needs to take place there. But, you know, back to, taxing and spending vis-a-vis taxing and investing, the Oregon Business Plan, has a number of business coalition members tied to it. The Oregon Business Council, which I'm involved with, Associated Oregon Industries, Portland Business Alliance, through the Portland Business Alliance, they've connected with all of the chambers throughout the state. Many of them have been involved. My point here is to say, this is not just a couple of three or four, a handful of folks with an idea. We're here to fly cover in the sense that we understand that it will be a difficult political decision to make. But we'll admire and respect you for making that decision, and not only that, we'll be there for you after you've made that decision. We've been there through OTIA 1, 2, and 3. We've been there through Connect Oregon. And I don't think that you're finding that, that the local folks are saying, gee, we don't want to invest in our transportation system. If we went back to that visual, I'm trying to think of the computer language, that the virtual tour. And if we're taking that virtual tour that we were speaking of a few moments ago from Boise back to the state of Oregon, I understand clearly what you're suggesting in the competitive issues, Representative Butler, that we have there. But I'd also like to compare that with what if we came across from a freeway back to the Oregon Trail in a wagon, you know, and had to drive the cars on a wagon train. That's not the answer either. We have to invest. It's important that we invest in our economy, in the jobs, in the state. And that's where the business coalition that's presenting this proposal to you is. We're saying we're not asking you to step forward on the plank. We're out there in front. We're going to be out there in front. We want to be arm in arms with you in terms of how we invest. You've invested over 6 years of my life in the Oregon Transportation Commission, understanding many of the aspects of the department and transportation and how we can do things a little bit better. And I think we have changed practices. I think the department is doing more things better today. That's a time for a different discussion. But I would like to say that, you know, the answer isn't there by cutting off dollars and not investing. There isn't a business person that I know of that doesn't understand that in order to be successful in business, you have to reinvest in business. We have to reinvest in education. We have to invest in health care. We have to invest in our transportation systems. And the Oregon Business Plan, if you look at the other initiatives, talk about those various elements. Remember, we're only talking about transportation today. Thank you. Steve?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming today.
Our pleasure.
And I look to continue the conversation.
Thank you for your time and leadership.
We do well. Please drive carefully wherever you're going. As I say to my family, don't muck up the system between here and there. Thank you all.
Thank you.
All right. Close the informational hearing. Thank you again for coming.
Madam Chair, I don't know that it's too late for committee bills, but I am concerned about rural road districts in Oregon. That is a possible tool that could be used. I understand that that most counties are closed off from the establishment of rural road districts, which stopped in probably the 50s or the 60s, because it just didn't feel like that. You know, it felt like that with the advent of the Oregon Transportation and those kinds of things, that rural road districts, taxing districts, would not be necessary. It's my understanding that that almost no county today, there might be one or two counties that qualify to actually, in terms of numbers of people. Back then, if you had over 2,000 or 3,000 people, then you didn't need a rural road district, because that was a lot of people. But I'm wondering if we need to have staff take a look at the definitions of rural road districts and reauthorize rural road districts. That's where people who surround the city of, fill in that small town's name, can come back and vote to go ahead and tax themselves a property tax. And again, those folks are normally not in compression because they are rural. They can vote a property tax to go ahead and maintain those roads. They can't, but for the past 30 or 40 years, Oregon has been unauthorized, those communities have been unauthorized to actually have rural road districts created. I'm fortunate I come from a county that I think has, from what Judge Joyce said the other day, I think he said five. I didn't know we had five rural road districts, but I'm not gonna contest what he said. So I would like a staff to look at that and at least get an opportunity. If we can't get a committee bill, I may have a priority that I could go ahead and establish, but we need to come back and give those. When we start talking about another tool for the toolbox, to use that overused phrase, I'm saying let's give them that as a tool. Let's let them come back and for those small communities allow themselves to tax themselves on a property tax basis. And it's by local vote. It's nothing we do. It's nothing that a county commissioner does that says we're gonna go and tell you that you've got to vote. They get themselves together and say, here's a way, and I talk to my onion farmers in eastern Oregon, and they tell me there's nothing better than our rural road districts. We spend less on our equipment maintenance. We spend less for our operation of our trucks. It costs us less fuel. And it's a very, very easy way for us to raise money and make money out of it by keeping good roads in rural Nyssa. I've heard that from my farmers in Nyssa. I've heard it from my farmers in Ontario. And then there are other rural road districts. But I'm looking at it and saying, it's too bad we can't do that in other small towns and cities that would, where folks are not in compression, would be willing to tax themselves to improve their roads.
Thank you, Representative Butler. We are at a point in the session where it is our priority bills, our individual priority bills we have to use. I think I'm trying to remember if there's some conversations going on about some type of road districts over in the Senate. And we can do some checking on that.
Well, that'd be wonderful, Madam Chair.
And I'm going to go ahead. We had one more item on the agenda, and we're going to go ahead and carry that item over till Monday. So, and thank them for being willing to do that. And I'll adjourn the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.